Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals for the afternoon session. We have only one oral argument today, and that's yours. Several others are being submitted without oral argument this afternoon. The case is Karen Liddell Adams versus State of Texas, and I will ask the clerk to call the case officially and announce the party's lawyers. Good. Mr. Minton, are you ready to proceed?
Ready, Your Honor.
All right.
May it please this honorable court, Ms. Shalafu. I understand it's the Tuesday afternoon before Thanksgiving, and I will do my best to be brief and return as much time to the court as I possibly can. I am fully aware that the court originally wanted to submit this case without oral argument. I felt that it was important to argue it because how ironic is it that we don't want to have a discussion about an issue of speech? Even more ironic, how ironic is it that I'm up here arguing a criminal case? This case involves not your typical crime. This isn't somebody that was pulled over with dope in their pocket. This isn't somebody that shot or assaulted somebody else. This is about somebody being sentenced to three felony convictions based on uttering speech. And as a lawyer, as a citizen, I have to admit at the outset of this argument that this entire conviction simply flies all over me as far as what was done here. Nonetheless, there were three statements made and three convictions. The first two, I'll get those so-and-sos, I know where Judge Walton keeps his gun. I think that those are easy. Neither one of those are threats. I don't, or at least they're not completed threats in the sense it's anticipated by the language of 3606. Saying I'm going to get somebody, as I pointed out in my reply brief, you can have as many as 16 definitions just in an online dictionary. It's what the word get means, only one of which means exacting revenge. And I think it's important for the court to keep in mind that there are actually two players involved in each one of these statements. There's the person making the statement, and then there's the person perceiving it who has no connection with the victims or the persons about whom the statements were made, and no real probability that any of these threats would ever get back to the victims or the intended recipients, or that it was even reasonably certain that they would do so and inhibit their public service. I understand the state's argument that it's important that there be a certain class of people that engage in public service free from the threat of retaliation. But I also understand that when you're talking about speech, you're talking about a preferred freedom, and I think that the state's argument implicit in the state's argument is that this somehow or another has to be political speech. Speech can be stupid. Speech can be pointless. It can be meaningless, or it can be just grumbling, like I think it was here, just blowing off steam. But I think, and this may be an unsophisticated viewpoint, but I think that before you send somebody away for 6 years for saying something, there's got to be a little more oomph behind what they said than simply saying, well, I know where Judge Walton keeps his gun. Okay, well, what's the rest of the sentence? I know where Judge Walton keeps his gun. I think I'll oil it for him. Sounds kind of ridiculous, but nonetheless, the statement itself is not a completed threat. And yet, this woman was convicted based on the subjective impression about what she thought Karen Adams meant. To me, the first two are both the easiest. I'll get whatever. What does get mean? I don't know. It could mean a lot of things, but not necessarily mean that she was going to inflict or she was threatening bodily harm. And that's another important point I want to bring up. I agree with the state. Harm doesn't necessarily have to be bodily harm. But they specifically alleged threat of bodily harm in the indictment in all three counts. Where's the threat of bodily harm in either of these first two statements? Let me take the third statement. If I had a gun, I'd shoot the sheriff. Look, everybody knows Roger Deeds is the sheriff of Hood County. But knowing that he's the sheriff of Hood County and saying that you're going to shoot him because he is the sheriff of Hood County, as opposed to he ran over your dog or something having nothing to do with public service, I think is entirely different. So I think that the third one comes a little closer to the mark of what was intended by the statute, but I still don't think that they get there because the evidence doesn't show that it was on account of his status as the sheriff or his public service. Over and over again in the record of this case, the witnesses, the star witnesses of the state, the Mrs. Kravitz's, the neighbors who turned her in, said, well, what do you think she meant by that? Well, it was my impression, or, well, I believe. Well, people can believe a lot of things, and people can take away different impressions from a single statement, but that doesn't make the statement itself criminal, and it doesn't make the statement itself a threat.
Excuse me, can I ask a question?
Absolutely.
Your argument that, in part, that we can't consider the context in which the statements were made and the circumstances surrounding it?
I think you can absolutely consider the context. Here's the problem between me and the state. We have a disagreement about what the context is. The context, it's undisputed that Karen Adams' son was indicted and, although not in this record, it's in a record of another case before this court, that he was convicted of capital murder and given a life sentence. I mean, I know I'm handling that appeal. But the context, consider the context. These two people go over to her house. They don't work for the sheriff's department. They don't work for the district court. They go over to her house. And they talk about, and, you know, one of them goes over there to say a prayer with her, and, you know. And she simply says, I'll get those, and uses a bad word. And, you know, and says, I know where Judge Walton keeps his gun. That's the context. But then to ask the witness, well, do you think it was on account of the fact that they might have had something to do with her son's indictment? Oh, yeah, that's what I think. Okay, that's not context. That's speculation. That's what the Court of Criminal Appeals was talking about in Gross versus State. Is it unreasonable speculation? No, probably not. But is it speculation nonetheless? I think that it is. And I think that you just simply can't get to the point where you can support a conviction based on these statements and based on this record. So, can you consider the context? Absolutely. But I think you have to consider all of the context, and you have to define what is the context. Somebody mad because their son got arrested? Sure, I don't have a problem with that. Somebody blowing off steam to somebody who has no connection with law enforcement or no connection with the grand jury? Maybe. So, yes, I agree. You can consider the context, and you can draw inferences from the evidence. But Jackson versus Virginia says that those inferences have to be rationally based. And Jackson versus Virginia has to say the conviction still has to be based on proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, let me bring up one other point with regard to Sheriff Deeds. The only time Deeds' name was ever mentioned during the questioning of the witness was when it was front-loaded by the DA into a question. Now, can you argue that, well, that's some evidence that she knew who Roger Deeds was, and that's some evidence to support the allegation in the indictment, because the indictment specifically referenced Roger Deeds. But then the issue is that proof beyond a reasonable doubt to support a conviction, a felony conviction? And I think no. I think that the court also has to consider its own words in the In Re BPH case, which the court handed down in 2002, and although that was a juvenile case, the court, and that's 83 Southwest 3rd 400, the court, I think, did a good job of noting that this is a result-oriented offense. A retaliatory threat is intended to put fear in somebody. And if you look at the vast number of cases where these retaliatory threats are upheld based on the sufficiency of the evidence, it's where it was connected, it was conveyed directly to the CPS worker. I'm going to kill you for breaking up my family. Or it's conveyed directly to the policeman. If you take me to jail, when I get out, I'm going to come back and kill you. Or conveyed directly to a witness. If you testify, you're dead. That's not what we have here. And that's why BPH and subsequently the Amarillo Court of Appeals in Wilkins versus State says that there has to have been at least a reasonable certainty that the speaker intended for this to inhibit or somehow hinder public service or was on account of that person's status. I mean, even a public servant can have a grudge against somebody that has absolutely nothing to do with the performance of their duties. In summary, I promised I'd give some of my time back because I think this is, maybe I'm wrong, I think some of this is pretty self-evident, but those first two statements, they're not threats. Are they dumb statements? Probably. Should they have been uttered? Probably not. Were they statements that were worth taking 6 years of somebody's life away? No, I don't think so. I think that those are easy reversals for lack of evidence. I think the one the court has to wrestle with is the third one with regard to the sheriff. And I think even under these circumstances, when you look at the record, and I believe it's at page 97 of volume 3, you know, because the district attorney has to prove so many elements of a crime, including venue, you know, you always got that little tail-end question on redirect examination. Well, did it happen in Hood? I may have asked you this, but did it happen in Hood County? Well, and this one is, well, do you think this was on account of Sheriff Deed's status as the sheriff? I believe it was. No predicate, no nothing, no foundation of underlying facts that would allow that to be a shorthand rendition of those facts. Simply the sheer speculation of a prosecution witness who, you know, had met with the prosecution and had been prepared for trial. I'm not suggesting that they lied about, I'm not suggesting in any way that they lied about their subjective impression. I'm just saying they were subjective impressions. And I think that the court, I think that the court has to apply a more exacting standard in a case involving criminalization of speech. Free speech is the rule. Even stupid speech is the rule. I think that the state had the burden, and the state can't meet its burden of proof by saying, well, nobody showed it was for anything else. The defendant doesn't have to. That's the state's burden of proof. If there's some presumption that applies in these circumstances, I didn't find it. And I'm not saying I couldn't have missed it, but I don't think I did. And for these reasons, the defendant and appellant respectfully prays that the court reverse, if not reverse all three, at least reverse the two convictions based on I'll get those so-and-sos and I know where the judge keeps his gun. But I think that all three need to be reversed, and I think that the court should enter judgment of acquittal. And I'll go ahead and return the rest of my time, such as it is, to the court.
I'm going to ask one more question.
Sure.
About your statement a few minutes ago that there needed to be evidence to a reasonable certainty that she intended for the threats to be conveyed to the
recipients. Okay.
Do you have a case that discusses that?
I think that, yes, Your Honor, that's Wilkins versus State that was cited in our reply brief, 279 Southwest 3rd 701. It's head note 9. As a result-oriented offense, the action being criminalized is the threat to harm and the intent to inhibit public service by others. Rather, we consider whether appellant made the statement with the intent to inhibit Judge Medina's service as a public official or with knowledge that it was reasonably certain that his statement would inhibit Judge Medina's service as a public official.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, Mr. Minton. We'll hear from, is it Chalifo?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
And may it please the court. As you said, I'm Megan Chalifo from the Hood County District Attorney's Office, representing the state in today's appeal. In two points of error, the appellant challenges the sufficiency of the evidence to support her three convictions for retaliation against Deputy Sheriff Jerry East, Judge Ralph Walton, and Sheriff Roger Deeds. The law regarding sufficiency of the evidence is well settled, and the standard of review is whether, after viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the prosecution, any rational trier of fact could find all of the elements of the offense beyond a reasonable doubt. And a person commits this offense of retaliation when she intentionally or knowingly threatens to harm another by an unlawful act in retribution or on account of their service or status as a public servant. In her brief, appellant challenges the sufficiency of the evidence to support several elements of this offense. As Mr. Minton said, the appellant first challenges this unlawful act element regarding her statement that she would get each of these three public servants. And the appellant argues that getting someone can mean any number of things. And generally speaking, the appellant is absolutely right. But the circumstances of this case and the actual language that this appellant used make it absolutely clear that she was referring to only one thing, and that was to intentionally threaten to harm these three public servants. Appellant's words cannot be divorced from the circumstances in which they were made. And in this case, the appellant talks about speculation regarding the meaning of her words. Well, the facts of this case show that appellant's son, Gordon Ray Lewis, was indicted for capital murder back in 2012. And shortly after that indictment, this appellant called one of her friends, Carmela Clark, to come to her house. An appellant did this because she wanted to tell her friend herself that her son had been indicted for capital murder before she heard from anybody else. And so Ms. Clark, being friends with this appellant for around 15 years and living in the same neighborhood there in Oak Trail Shores, did what she could to try to comfort this appellant. And so they talked about this indictment, and Ms. Clark told her that an indictment is not evidence of her son's guilt, that the state was going to have to put on its case, and that they would have to prove her son was guilty of capital murder before he would be convicted. And Ms. Clark could see that her words were not bringing the comfort she had hoped to this appellant. And so she asked the appellant if she wanted to pray with her. And they prayed about her son's upcoming case. And Ms. Clark prayed that in the case, that the guilty people would be found guilty and that the innocent people would go free. And hearing this prayer, appellant became even more upset and threw down Ms. Clark's hands and got up and then began making those threats. She said that the state was going to need evidence and they wouldn't find it, and that she was going to get Jerry East, Judge Walton, and Roger Deeds. And then she kept saying that she was going to get all those mother effers. She used a word, a profanity, and kept talking about it. And she went on to say how she was going to carry out this threat, that she used to work at the courthouse as a housekeeper, and she knew where Judge Walton kept his gun up there at the courthouse, and that she was going to be able to get through security because she knew someone. And so it's the entire subject matter of this conversation revolved around her son's capital murder indictment and about how she was going to get all of these people. The case law in this state makes clear that threats of physical harm need not be directly expressed, but may be contained in veiled statements, nonetheless implying injury to the recipient when viewed in all the circumstances. And that's what we have here, that the word get in any other context could mean something very innocent. But in this context, given the seriousness of appellant's words and the manner in which she was saying them and how those words were received, it's absolutely clear that what she meant by that threat was to cause bodily injury to these three people. I want to respond to something that Mr. Minton talked about the fact that Jerry East, Judge Walton, and Roger Deeds were not present when these threats were made, that these three people were not in the appellant's living room when she said these things, or the fact that she did not go to the courthouse or to the sheriff's department to say these things. And in Doyle versus State, a case from the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals in 1983, that court said that the fact that the party threatened was not present when the threat was made is no defense. And that the statute, this court stated in In Re BPH that the appellant referred to, this court stated that the statute does not require that the actor even intend to carry out the threat, but rather that she only intend to make the threat. And furthermore, the retaliation statute does not require that the threatened harm be imminent. Based on the appellant's words and the context in which they were made, the evidence is sufficient to support this unlawful act element of the offense. Appellant goes on to challenge the sufficiency of the evidence to show that she made these threats because these three people were public servants. An appellant talked to you about Wilkins versus State, a case out of the Amarillo Court of Appeals from 2007. And in that case, the Amarillo Court of Appeals held that the retaliation statute requires that the threat have been made with an intent to inhibit the service of that public servant. And other courts of appeals across this state have rejected the holding in Wilkins versus State because it adds an element into the offense that is not there in the statute. And in fact, this court, in Raybon versus State, a case from earlier this year, this court expressly rejected the holding in Wilkins versus State. Given that these threats were made during a conversation or conversations regarding her son's capital murder indictment, an appellant's words that she was going to get Deputy Sheriff Jerry East because he had been after her son for a long time, it is clear that the only reason she was making these threats is because these three people were public servants. They were the deputy sheriff there in Hood County, the sheriff in Hood County, and the district judge there in Hood County. She believed those three people had something to do with her son's indictment for capital murder.
She believed. How do you know what she believed?
Well, I guess we don't have a way of seeing into the appellant's mind at the time she was saying these things.
Nor do you have a way of seeing into the mind of Ms. Clark when she understood things about what was said, do you?
No.
And you don't have a way of seeing into the mind of Ms. Tillerson when she said that appellant looked like she could have carried out that threat, do you?
No.
So a good bit of your case is based upon what these two persons may have had in their mind, not what was in the mind of the appellant.
What we have, those witnesses did talk about their subjective beliefs regarding appellant statements, but we also have testimony from those two people about what they were talking with appellant about.
And I understand that. And let me ask you another question. Was there any evidence that Judge Walton actually had a gun in the courthouse?
There was another housekeeper from the Hood County Courthouse, Gloria Bird, who testified in the case. And she talked about how she also cleans Judge Walton's courtroom, and that she knows that there is a lockbox there on the bench, and that she understands that to be where Judge Walton...
Another understanding person. Another person testified about what she understood as opposed to what she knew from observation or a factual assertion of the existence of a gun in some place in the courthouse.
Well, Ms. Bird also talked about how it would have been inappropriate for her to open up that lockbox.
Well, I'm not arguing that,
ma'am.
I'm not asking you that. I don't mean to use the word argue, because I'm really just trying to understand your argument. What evidence was there, ma'am? What evidence was there that the appellant in this case had a gun? Did she have a gun?
I don't believe there's anything in the record to show that the appellant had a gun, nor do I believe it is required that the appellant have any intent to carry out these threats.
I didn't ask you that. I asked you if there was any evidence that dealt with any proof that the appellant in this case, Karen Liddell Adams, had access to a gun.
Well, there's the appellant's own words that she knew where Judge Walton...
If I had a gun is the language, and I'm wanting to know if there was any proof about the fact that she might have had access to a gun other than this reference to, I know where Judge Walton keeps his gun. Other than that, was there any evidence presented that Ms. Adams actually had access to a gun or actually possessed a gun?
Other than the appellant's own words and the testimony of Gloria Bird, to my memory, I do not believe there is any other testimony about it.
Thank you very much.
Now, I have a question, too.
Yes.
Going back to what I asked Mr. Minton, sort of the same question. Was there any evidence that the appellant knew or believed that her friends would convey the threats to any of those three intended recipients? Is that not a requirement under the statute that the threats be received by the recipients? Not necessarily to inhibit their performance, but for the other reason that's been stated, to put fear into their minds.
Well, we know from Doyle versus State that there's no requirement that the target of the threats be present or have heard the threats for the evidence to be sufficient to uphold a conviction for retaliation. And your question to me was there any evidence that the appellant knew that her friends, Carmela Clark and Mary Tillerson, were going to talk to the police? Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah, that's good enough.
Okay.
Probably better than I phrased it.
I don't know that there's any evidence in the record that appellant believed that her friends were going to go to the sheriff's department. I think that may be why some of this was so, well, and I don't know that that was required, that the speaker make those threats with an intent that the listener go to the police to report it.
Or to the intended recipients.
Or, yeah, I don't...
The person's being threatened.
No, because the statute does not require that a person have... that the speaker even have any intent to carry out the threat. The only requirement for the intent element is that the speaker intend to make a threat of bodily harm. I see that I'm out of time, and for all these reasons, I'll ask that this court affirm the conviction. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Chalifo. And is there any rebuttal, Mr. Minton?
Brief rebuttal, Your Honor. The state's argument kind of brings up some of the points that I probably inadequately expressed in my opening argument. But there was this discussion about Karen Adams' son being indicted for capital murder. I stand to be corrected, but I don't think there was any reference in the record that he was indicted in Hood County. Now, we all know he was. I mean, the record of it's down in the office. But as far as what the jury heard, that is the finder of fact that ultimately made the decision to convict and sentence, I don't think that information was ever before them. I think that there, if there were shortcomings in the state's evidence in this case, I think it was a combination of two things. I think it was first and foremost, this isn't your run-of-the-mill felony. Because of the nature of the crime, the criminalization of speech. The second thing is this case was closely tied with three others that were tried, and you know, having tried a civil case twice because a motion for new trial was granted, I mean, you think you proved things that you thought you knew, but you didn't, but you knew it because you were involved in the other case as well. And I think that's what kind of bridged the gap for the state in their minds. But even with regard to the issue of why she was upset or why she was saying the things that she did, come back to what Justice Meyer said, I think if the court looks at the record, I think it was Mrs. Clark who said this. She says, well, I think it was because her son got indicted for capital murder that she was upset. So again, we come back to subjective belief. I think under the circumstances, this conviction is almost, it's almost Salem-like. I mean, it's almost as though some witness came forward and accused Karen Adams of communing with Satan. You have a busybody neighbor who at best thought she heard something that may or may not have been said and may or may not have been what the defendant meant. I think the defendant's statements are the best evidence, or in this case, the best lack of evidence of a retaliatory threat. And you can't plug up the holes by coming back and either saying, well, it couldn't have been anything else, or by saying, well, I believe she said. I'm not defending the content of these statements. I think it was a dumb thing to say. I mean, there are some things you can say that are just bound to get you in trouble, and these were them. But
Mr. Minton, if we were to interpret the use of the language I'm going to get, Judge Walton, or I'm going to get Sheriff Deeds, to mean a threat of bodily harm, what precedent might we be setting for people who might be a political opponent in each of these people's future in terms of each of them are elected officials? What if an opponent merely said, I'm going to get the sheriff, in the sense of I'm an opponent and I want to beat him at the polls?
Oh, well, careful on that word beat.
beat him at the polls.
You don't want to
could
beat him.
Be also physical.
You don't. Well, it could be.
I mean, if we go so far as to accept the words "get" to mean a threat of bodily harm,
and I
wonder about the precedent.
I think that you're rightly concerned about this, and as a public servant, I've never been a public servant. I've never been elected official.
You're a public servant today as an officer of the court.
Well, okay, but not threatened. But I think that there is an important policy that underlies the statute. You should be able to do your job without somebody, without somebody in your ear telling them what they're going to do to you. But I think when you come down, it's like baseball. I think free speech is like baseball. When it comes down to, I think that the tie has to go to the speaker, and I think for those reasons and the reasons you expressed, I'm going to beat my opponent. I'm going to run against Judge Walton, and I'm going to beat him. Oh, you're going to beat him? Well, I'm going to run against him and beat him. Well, that's not what I thought you meant. Have I committed a felony? I think that's, like I said, I just think if you're going to convict somebody of a felony for saying something, there has to be, and forgive me for not being more eloquent, the statement just has to have a little more oomph to it than the ones that are in the record here. And for those reasons, I think that the court, I think the first two are easy ones. I think those are easy acquittals. I think the third one was a little more difficult, but again, where's the evidence that, I'm going to shoot the sheriff. I'm going to shoot the dog catcher. I'm going to shoot the postman. Are they identifying the person, or are they threatening them because of their, because of their involvement? Involvement, in particularly in this case, involvement in Gordon Lewis's case, at least from the record, is at best highly, highly speculative. But for those reasons, we urge the court to reverse this case and enter a judgment of acquittal on all three counts. And unless there are any further questions, thank you for your time. And thank you for hearing oral argument on this. I think this was
thank
important.
Thank you for coming. And, any time that someone wants to make an oral argument and has gotten a notice that their case is not set on the oral argument docket, we're happy to reconsider. We like having oral arguments. Thank you for coming. Appreciate
Thank you,
your
Honor.
Arguments. Your case is submitted. And with that, I think that we're through here today, and we will stand adjourned.